I feel like I should come with a warning label. You know, this teacher may digress into topics that seem unrelated to what I came here for or what you came here for. Try to categorize that as a character defect, if you're familiar with the term. I am a recovering alcoholic and addict. I'll use the term celebrated, although I didn't do anything about it, but I just passed the 30-year mark of sobriety in June. So, you know, in America, you would applaud, but that's okay. I know you're much more repressed around here. And I will probably make a lot of silly American versus English jokes today. So, and walking around London and riding around the last couple of days, I realized there's an awful lot of people who don't have English accents, and I find that very disappointing, because that's what I come here for, is to hear the way you people talk. But that's just life. Things keep changing. And if all those people start walking through the tunnel, God knows what will happen. This is my second time to teach for London Insight. I was here in 2010. It's just unbelievable. You know, 5 years just disappears. What I do with my work of blending Buddhism and 12 steps, recovery and Dharma, however you want to characterize it, you know, it's something that just arose out of my own experience. Not really out of any proselytizing impulse. But to have that just sort of self-expression turn into something where I get to come to London and teach and a bunch of people want to hear me speak is a miracle. It's what in recovery we call the miracle, you know, the miracle of recovery miracle of sobriety. And I know it's not a miracle because there are karmic causes. But in that certain way, when I reflect over my life and where I've been and where I've come to, it seems remarkable. So I'm very grateful to be here. I'm very grateful for the service people are doing today and for this opportunity. And mostly I hope we'll enjoy ourselves today, and I hope that something useful will come out of it. My basic impulses in my teaching, kind of the core ideas, are one, to help people in the recovery to develop a meditation practice. Because I used to go to 11th step meetings, and if you're not familiar with all the steps, the 11th step is the one that suggests you should meditate. I would go to 11th step meetings, and there'd be a period of 5 minutes of meditation, and then people for an hour would talk about how they weren't able to meditate for those 5 minutes. And I thought, they need help. And I'm the person to do it. Da, da, da. Mighty Mouse. I don't know if you get that reference, but anyway. Here he comes to save the day. Okay. The other impulse is, maybe there's two others, but the other major impulse is to help people who really struggle with the language of the steps and the concepts of the steps and the culture of 12-step programs to be able to have a way in through Buddhist teachings, which a lot of people in contemporary culture and educated people need another way to hear the ideas of the 12 steps. Because when they hear God, or they hear powerless, or they hear character defect, they turn off. And, I understood the steps as meaning something that wasn't exactly contained in that language. And so I've come to see the 12 steps as kind of an archetypal path that has parallels in other spiritual paths, notably Buddhism, the other path that I'm most familiar with. So those are my two kind of main impulses in teaching. Everything else kind of comes out of that. I also have sort of a hidden agenda to get people in the Buddhist world to see how the 12 steps can help them, even if they aren't, don't identify as addicts, because I think the 12 steps have some wisdom that's, even though you can find it in the Dharma, it's not emphasized in the Dharma. And in the 12-step world, the concept of suffering and the cause of suffering being clinging is very real. It's not theoretical. We've lived it, we've felt it, and we've seen the truth of it for ourselves. And so that there's a connection we make that I think sometimes people who are just interested in Buddhism as this kind of spiritual path, and I'm going to become enlightened, miss that kind of core idea. I was actually at Amaravati Monastery yesterday, which is a Theravada monastery. If you don't know about it, you should go there. It's about half an hour train ride away from London. And one of my main teachers is now the abbot there, Ajahn Amaro. He's English, but he used to be the abbot of a monastery in California where I wouldn't see him at the monastery, but I would see him a lot in California. And he's been a big supporter of my work and actually read through my first book, One Breath at a Time, and gave me notes on it. So in any case, I went out there yesterday to visit, and I just sat and I chatted with him for a while, and then I kind of sat back and listened to the questions people were asking him. And this group of, I think they were Sri Lankans, came up, and all they wanted to ask about was enlightenment. Well, what's enlightenment? And what's nirvana? And how do we get there? What do we have to do? And I just thought, that's not really my thing. I don't know what enlightenment is, and I figure if that's where I'm supposed to end up, it'll take care of itself. What I know about is I show up one day at a time and I turn the results over to the Dharma, or to the law of karma. I do my best. If I'm like, oh, how do I get there? I want to be there. I'm here. So it doesn't really help me to be looking at that and wishing I was there, to having somebody tell me how to get there. So, just do what you're doing. And, if you're meant to get there, you will. So today, we'll do some meditation. Probably not a whole lot, because mostly a day like this is about our dialogue. I do teach retreats that are more meditation-oriented, actually next weekend, if you're free and you would like to come out to County Clare in Ireland. I'll be co-teaching a weekend with Vince Cullen, so it's still open. And you can see it on my website, kevingriffin.net. That was a word from our sponsor. But for days like this, I'm more like to just, it's more a connection and a conversation. I will give you some meditation instructions. We'll sit. And this day particularly, I asked Louise, who's the mucky muck, I guess, of London Insight, what topic she'd like. I gave her a couple of topics. I gave her my basic Buddhism and the 12 steps, and then I said, and I've got this new book coming out called Recovering Joy. And she's like, well, let's do that. So you may have seen there's some in the lobby. This is my new book. If you haven't read my other books, don't get this. Get my other ones first. That's my advice, just in terms of the conversation. But this is called Recovering Joy. And my impulse in writing this was, once again, my writing, the topics that I write about really come as a response to things that I see around me, and particularly that I see in my teaching. And one of the things that I started to see was that people who would come to my retreats and workshops I could see that people were developing insight and they were starting to practice more and understand the Dharma. But there was still this kind of, I felt like a heaviness, kind of a seriousness. And you see this in the Buddhist world too, kind of like, oh, I need to meditate. This kind of grim determination to something. solve myself. And in the recovery world, it can manifest as, you know, I have to write inventory about that. You know, oops, I said the wrong thing. Quick, let me go home and write inventory, make amends, you know, and pray and call my sponsor. And all of that is great, right? But when it becomes this treadmill of kind of like watching over your shoulder, watching out, I have to, you know, I'm constantly worried about if I, you know, do something unskillful that I have to, do penance for it. It can become kind of that same kind of grim thing of, well, why did I come here? Why did I get clean? You know, to sit around and judge myself. You know, it's like, I'm a human being. I make mistakes. You know, that's basically, you know, the definition of a human being, a flawed being, you know, and if I can't forgive myself and enjoy my life, then something's not working. And so that was kind of, I was like, okay, let me do a book on being happy, but not one of these smiley books. Everybody should be happy all the time, and if you're not happy, there's something wrong with you. There's a lot of annoying books like that, and I don't read them, so I just think they're annoying by their titles and their covers, and especially the author photos. You know, I just want to slap those people, you know. New York Times bestseller. Oh, screw you. So, I thought I would work with some of the ideas that are in the book today. And you know, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to start by just talking about some of the ways that the Buddha talks about happiness. And then we'll do some meditation. And then we can maybe just talk about meditation for a while. And then I'm going to do some exercises. I'm going to have you talk to each other, you know, and explore some of these ideas and see where we get to. I don't teach with a tight agenda. You know, I come in with themes and ideas, and then I see where it goes. And so I hope that works for you. This is something that's actually not in the book, because I just thought of it in the last couple of days. And one of the dangers of writing a book is something, a bug or something fell out of my hair. One of the dangers of writing a book is that once it's written down, then you know, you can't change it. I understand James Joyce used to go into bookstores and pull his books off the shelf and scratch things out and write things in the margin. No, I should have said it this way, you know, which I can sympathize. So, you know, the other day I was thinking, oh, God, I should have talked about this in the book. So here you go. You're getting something that's not in the book. So I started reflecting on what I talk about in the book mainly is very narrow in terms of what the Buddha talked about with happiness. And he describes three forms of happiness. He says pleasure, you could say. There's sensual pleasure, which is what got us here, actually, our attachment to sensual pleasure. And you know, he doesn't say sensual pleasure is a bad thing. He says that it's just risky, as there's a tendency to get attached to it. And he also says it's kind of crude. You know, that it's not very subtle. It's basically saying you can do better than this. And so the more refined form of pleasure is meditative pleasure, or meditative joy, that you get when your mind quiets down, the body gets stable and still, and you settle into that place of peace. And lots of different levels of joy and pleasure can come through that. But just the level of just settling and being quiet for a little while is pleasant. And you can realize, oh, this is unrelated to any external or sensual experience. It's not dependent upon anything other than these simple conditions of stillness and silence. So that's a more refined level of pleasure. But there's also a risk that we can become attached to that, because you start to find, oh, I love getting into this concentrate. Oh, my mind is empty. Great. Somebody makes a noise, you're like, would you be quiet? I'm trying to meditate. It's like, oh, you're getting a lot of peace out of that. And so the next level of joy the Buddha describes is the joy of insight. And this is really the deep joy of letting go, of seeing the truth, of knowing, oh, that's how things are. And so the ultimate form of that is enlightenment. But just, you know, for people in recovery, what we call the moment of clarity, when you realize, oh, I'm an addict. I need to stop doing this. That's a moment of insight, right? There's that moment of relief. Oh, I don't have to do this. That's actually an insight. So step one in the 12 steps, it says we admitted we were powerless over whatever your addiction is, that our lives become unmanageable. That's actually a moment of insight. And it's a moment. So one of the things that I talk about, one of the first things I talk about in this book is about the joy of letting go as related to your addiction. That for me, it was the first day. And I don't know how many people have it as the first day. But early on, there's a moment, I think, for each of us when we go, wow, this is great. I'm free. I'm not addicted anymore. I'm not stuck. I don't have to live that way anymore. And that's this tremendous moment of freedom. And that's actually what the Buddha is talking about. You know, that's because this word insight is a tricky one, because in our culture, insight refers to a thought or an idea. Oh, I had an insight. What? And it's an idea that you're going to tell somebody about. In Theravadan Buddhism, when we talk about vipassana, insight, seeing clearly, we're talking about an experience, a knowing. So that when you're meditating and your mind is all wandering and you don't realize it, and then you realize it and you go, wow, I'm like spacing out, and you feel how your body's kind of tense, you're agitated. And then you come back to your breath and you relax. You've experienced the first, second, and third noble truths. You've experienced the suffering of clinging, and because you've been clinging to a thought. And then you've experienced the freedom of letting go. I've come back. Now I'm let go of that thought. That simple moment is actually an insight. And it's an insight because you've experienced it. It's what Joseph Goldstein, if you know him, one of the great Western Dharma teachers, his first book was called The Experience of Insight. And that title itself is actually kind of, it doesn't really make sense in our language. Right? We don't experience insights. So this is one of the problems with translation. When we try to translate from a culture and from an ancient language, we use modern terms that have to then be retranslated. So the experience of sobriety is an insight in these terms. It's a knowing. It's a felt knowing, if that makes sense. A felt knowing. Which is more powerful than a thought. Because a felt knowing goes deep. And that letting go is profound. It's not just, oh, I should stop drinking. Oh, I'm an alcoholic. I've got a problem. No, it's not that. It's, oh, I have to stop. It's over. The end is here. So that's the first joy of recovery, right? Even though we think of it, it's usually characterized in these sort of negative terms of, oh, you know, you were in denial, you know. Okay, you've stopped. Now you need to start working the steps. Like, yeah, you do. But can we enjoy this for a moment? Can we appreciate it? Instead of like, okay, get to work. And watch out, because you might relapse. And you might. Most people do. At some point. All right. So that was starting out by talking about the ways the Buddha talks about happiness or joy, the joy of sensual pleasure, the joy of meditation, the joy of insight. So some of the other ways, the Buddha talks about the joy of generosity. It's one of the first things he teaches lay people, which is fundamentally a joy of letting go, but something to just be enjoyed. And when you give something to someone, whether it's material or whether it's giving them time or service, And one of the things the Buddha emphasizes is that when you do something skillful, when you do something kind or generous, be there for that experience. Feel it and enjoy the joy. Take it in. So again, we maybe have a little bit in our culture of, well, I shouldn't, you know, it's bragging if I think about what a good person I am. Yeah, okay. It's not that you're thinking about what a good person you are. It's just that you're realizing this feels good when I do this service. And acknowledge that, but don't just do it and, oh, well, it was nothing. Okay. You can, that's okay on that level of ego. But on the, if you can feel it, what happens is that you're reinforcing that behavior. You're making really clear, intentionally and consciously, to yourself, oh, that's something that feels good. I should do that more often. And you're expanding your happiness, because the Buddha says there are three moments of happiness around a skillful action. There's the anticipation, oh, I'm going to do this nice thing. There's the enjoyment of doing it, and then there's the memory and the reflection of it. Now, again, that might not sound Buddhist, because aren't we supposed to just be here now all the time? Well, yeah, but still, you can be there for each of those moments and be present for them and take joy in them. You know, and it's actually part of the practice to be able to separate the ego part of it, the, well, I'm doing a good thing, from the, oh, that feels good. And can you notice that? Right? Can you notice when you start to go into the pride and let go of that and just go, no, you know, just let me enjoy this. So this is the effort, you know, to do this practice of recovering joy. It's, you know, it requires us to kind of do some intentional things and watch and be present for certain things. So there's the joy of generosity. The Buddha talks about, this is a great alliteration, the bliss of blamelessness. The bliss of blamelessness is that knowing that you have not done any harm. And, you know, so it's the opposite of guilt. And we have these moments in recovery where we realize, oh, wow, in the past I would have done this, but because I don't do that anymore, you know, you kind of go, ah. Oh. So, you know, I was at a pub last night, you know, and to just be there and people are drinking and not, you know, and when you've been sober for a while, people who are drinking really look ugly, you know, and the behavior and the whole thing of it, you know, it's unpleasant, you know, and to just be able to be like, oh, I don't have to do that. Oh, there's just that moment of joy in that. Oh, I can really enjoy. I was there to hear music, and I was really enjoying the music and the atmosphere and meeting people. And it's great. But there was also this, wow, I don't have to go over and be like, oh, should I have one more now? Or should I do a shot of tequila to go with the beer? Or maybe I need to go outside and smoke a joint? Or maybe I might need a line of Coke just to get like, because I think I drank too much. You know, the bliss of like, don't have to. Just the other thing that I like to describe as the bliss of blamelessness is if you're driving late at night and you get pulled over and you know that you're not holding and that you haven't been drinking, and you think, worst I can get is a speeding ticket. This is great. That's happiness. Oh, generosity, the bliss of blamelessness. One of the joys the Buddha talks about is taking joy in the happiness of others. Now, that's something that makes no sense in our culture. In fact, you know, I love the German word Schadenfreude, right? Which is just the opposite, taking joy in the pain of others. I think we probably do that more. But taking joy in the joy of others, well, the easiest way to do this is with babies and little children. Just, you know, when you look at a child or a pet or somebody's dog, you know, already today I've had a half a dozen of these moments. This morning I'm staying in Hampstead Heath, and I was actually walking through the park to get from the flat that I'm staying. And there was this great dog that came out of the woods running down, and then it stopped. And its owner was coming out of the woods behind it. It was like a sheepdog, you know, it ran ahead and then it spun around, took, are you with me? Are you still there? And, you know, looking at its owner, and then, you're still there? Okay, good. And it took off again. And I was just walking along, smiling and taking joy in the joy of this dog and its owner. And then on the tube, a couple of babies got on with their mothers. And I was just, look at them, you know. And that's mudita, it's called. You know, and all it takes, and you can have that joy, but it is really helpful. I mean, I noticed, I'm sitting on the tube and I'm smiling, you know. You're not supposed to smile here. You're supposed to be grim, you know. This is a miserable thing. We're deep underground going somewhere with a lot of people that we don't want to be with. And some of them smell, you know. But really, it's just, this is partly about attitudes, right? Because we know where you direct your attention and what you choose to pay attention to. You can make choices. I mean, I'm a very negative person, frankly. Maybe that hasn't come across yet, but I'll try to prove that as the day goes on. But yeah, I mean, I've learned to an extent to kind of go, just look for the good. You know, and it's not even like think positive. It's just sit there. Is there something around here that's pleasant to engage with? And so, you know, just seeing little babies on the train is, you know, you find yourself smiling without making effort. And then, as the Buddha says, to take that in, to enjoy the joy. I mean, you don't have to. It's okay to just feel the joy. But it's helpful to see, I'm feeling happy right now. Because one of the things that I do is I go, I'm depressed. I'm in a bad mood. Or, I've got to go teach. And I'm like, geez, people are going to be looking at me, or whatever, you know. I've got jet lag. I can make up a story and focus on that. Or I can make up another story. If they're all stories, might as well pick one that's going to feel good. So these are some of the forms of joy that the Buddha talks about. And I would say they all involve being present. You know, if you're not present, you can't really appreciate anything. You know, you're just caught up in your own head. I mean, even if you're spacing out and having a pleasant fantasy, when you realize it's not actually happening, there's always going to be like a kind of bitter taste with that. I think maybe not. Maybe I'm just taking my own version of it. But I know that when I'm meditating and I'm spacing out, and even if it's a pleasant thought, that when I come back, my body doesn't really feel right. A lot of what I feel in meditation is kind of energetic, and also sometimes feels chemical, or like adrenaline or some kind of cortisol. Or, you know, nowadays meditation teachers have to be like neuroscientists and chemical. I don't know. I don't know what it all is. I haven't memorized it all. I'm getting too old to try to remember all this stuff. But I can feel it. It's like that kind of poisonous feeling in the body. So being present is kind of a requirement for any of this stuff to work, which is what our practice is about, right? So I think that is a logical lead-in to doing some meditation. If there is anything that's pressing on someone's mind right now that you feel, I'm not going to be comfortable unless I ask this question, I will respond to that. But otherwise, we can go ahead. You're all too polite to interrupt me.